everybody, and welcome to the podcast All Things Food. I am your host, Nikki Hirsthaus. I am a registered dietitian, foodie, yoga teacher, and lover of food stories. I'm really excited to bring you this week's episode, so let's get started. Bringing you a huge episode with Nate Smith. Nate is a third generation Ngāi Tahu fisherman, father, New Zealand producer, and all-round harvester of wild things. For the past 7 years, Nate has been the owner and operator of the beast that is Gravity Fishing New Zealand. Nate is a fellow kaitake with Eat New Zealand, and he's leading the way in sustainable fishing in New Zealand. We dive into a conversation about all things fish.
Hi, Nate. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, how's it going, Nikki? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good. Thanks, Nate. So great to have you here, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation today. And I've given a little bit of an introduction to this episode, but I'd love if you could take us back to where your story begins in the world of fish and what path took you to get you to where you are today.
Yeah, sweet. Well, I've been a fisherman for 14 years now in the commercial sector. And I guess the thing for me was I physically noticed what was going on out there in the wild environment. So I was putting in, you know, X amount of effort for a bigger company that I used to work for in Sanford. So I fished for them for about 11 years. And at the time I was catching blue cod for them and also some crayfish. And I was using an industrial method of fishing called cod potting. And that kind of says it all when you say industrial method of fishing, doesn't it? So yeah. I'm out there to catch as much fish as I can for a company that is an absolute powerhouse and a global stand as far as seafood and things go. So yeah, I noticed a decline in the catch versus the effort that I was putting in. And so I went back to industry and I just sort of said, you know, I'm putting in X amount of effort each day and I've been averaging, you know, sort of 750 to 800 kilograms of blue cod a day. Now I'm only averaging, it sort of went in phases. Like 1 year I noticed a decline and then I was like, wow, that's quite a significant amount. Wonder what's happening there. And then the following year is when I was like, wow, crikey, you know, we're down to 300 kilos a day, which is really significant. You know, it's almost half of what we were catching with the effort that we were putting in. So when I went back to industry, they just basically said, up your effort. So i.e. I was working 8 cod pots at the time. They just said, you know, put 12 or 15 cod pots on. And that just didn't sit well with me. I was like, that's not really the answer that I was looking for. I was kind of looking for more support, maybe with some scientific evidence to back it up with what's going on. Has this happened before? You know, the historical data. And I didn't really get the help that I was after. So I just went out on my own to do my own research. So I've spent hours in offices with Ministry for Primary Industry offices, field offices in the fisheries department. And from there, they gave me some really, really valuable information. They're like super helpful. And I just basically looked at historical data for my specific area because under quota management in New Zealand, there is 10 areas and we work in an area called Area 5, which is the bottom half of the South Island. So from Slope Point in the Catlins all the way up to Awaroa Point, which is just north of Milford Sound. So about 245 to 250 nautical miles of coastline is Area 5. So it's quite significant. The area that I fish in is actually the biggest fishing area in the country. So we provide a significant amount of exports, you know, as far as New Zealand's concerned, on our little wee island that we're in the middle of the Pacific. Mm-hmm. We catch a lot of fish and we export a lot of fish from my area. And I see it all go. I see it get caught. I see it get unloaded. I've seen it in the factories, you know, like it's a big amount of fish. It's a big business. But yeah, going back to it, Nikki, basically I was just like, this is not good enough. So from there, I had some conversations with my brother-in-law, Mark Irwin, who has got his own import-export fishing business over in Canada. And at the time, he was just trying to recruit more fishers so that he could have the good story to be told on his platform. And, you know, him and I just bounced ideas off each other about how I could move forward with my business and be fishing in a more sustainable manner with the historical data that I'd gained. So once I looked at it and I could see that it was just kind of a steady decline in the fish stocks for blue cod specifically, that's when I was like, right, less fish needs to come out of the water. That's my answer. Less effort and less fish needs to come out of the water. So with that, you know, you don't really have a gauge on how much fish swims into a cod pot. That's why I use the word industrial method, because you can set a cod pot and get a couple hundred kilos of fish in it. There's no way that you can stop that amount of fish getting in there. Once you set it, they just go in and they're stuck in there. So the easiest option was to go to hook and line. So then we did some research and figured out that there was these machines designed and developed in Iceland, and the Norwegian people as well, they used those jigging machines up there. So we had a look at it and we ended up getting 8 machines to start with. And we started catching fish with hook and line. And before we launched, we probably did about 18 months of research and development. So I was sending fish over to Canada each week of different species throughout the year so that we could send to a specific chef in Toronto who could tell us when that specific fish species was in season. Yeah. So leading up to launching Gravity, that's what we were doing in behind the scenes. So I was still fishing to one of the big, like I was still kind of fishing small amounts to the big company, but at the same time trying to develop my own way forward with this, whereby I was trying to be more sustainable with my whole operation. And so once we got it to a place that we had all of the necessary information that we needed, so I could design and develop a 12-month calendar for eaters so that they could physically see that here's a period of time throughout the next 12 months that the specific fish species is going to be in season. So it's going to have its best oil content, its best fat content, and that's when we should be harvesting and eating these things, because it's of the most nutritional benefit for us as humans to consume. And so we went deep on it. We didn't want to do this sort of half-ass. So once we got that info, we made this calendar, and then we started to get into it full swing. I launched Gravity back in 2016. Yeah, the beginning of 2016, we launched Gravity. And we went to just wanted to do whole fish, because there's a significant amount of waste that goes with fish on a commercial basis when you land to a licensed fish receiver who is of mass. So basically, I used to land gill and gut blue cod. So there's a conversion fraction that comes into account with that, because when you're allocated quota, it's 1-to-1. So example, I want to lease 1,000 kilograms of blue cod. I pay the lease to the private quota owner or the big fishing company. I then have the property right for the next 12 months during that fishing season. And so with that 1,000 kilograms that I leased in, that's all I'm allowed to take. If you go over that, say if you catch 1,100 kilograms, then you get what's charged, and it's like a fine basically. And that's called deemed value. And that comes from the MPI platform, the regulators, that basically says, you know, this is what it's worth, so this is how much we're going to charge you over your allocation of what you've paid for. So you end up getting a bill from MPI, and then at the end of the 12-month season, you get a final bill from them that's your deemed value statement that you've paid for. So you really don't want to go over what you have been allocated, because it does become very expensive and you'll go backwards really quickly. So with that one-to-one regime of landing a state of fish that is gill and gut, I think it's about one, just off the top of my head, I think it's about 1.4. So every 1 kilogram, I've got to catch 1.4 kilograms of fish to compensate for that. So effectively, I'm taking out 1,400 kilograms of whole fish product, but I'm only landing 1,000 kilos. So there's 400 kilograms of waste there by taking the gills out of the skeletal structure and the guts out. So that's the conversion fraction. And if I was doing fillets, which everybody really likes to have a nice boned out fillet in front of them when they go and purchase it because it's easy and it's convenient, then you go into the real deep state of waste, which is it's 2.6. So for every 1,000 kilograms of boneless blue cod fillets, you have to catch 2.6 tons of fish to get that. So there's 1,600 kilograms of waste, if that makes sense. So, yeah, so that was a really quick way that we could go, okay, let's just go one-to-one. Let's go whole fish. Let's not touch the product. Now, how do we get that in a state that people can, as a consumer or an eater, can deal with and it's still going to get to them fresh? Because obviously we're not cutting the fish at all, so its gut cavity and everything is still intact. So we did some R&D on that and figured out that the process of ikijimi was going to be the best. So this is an ancient Japanese technique that's been used obviously for years in that culture, and it's just starting to be adopted worldwide for people who are doing whole fish, because it kind of, with this process, it really sets the fish up for its journey. So it gives it its shelf life, it restores quality to the fish. There's a whole bunch of science that goes with the ikijimi technique, but effectively it sets the fish up. And it humanely kills the fish instantly as well. And just, yeah, everything about it is epic. So the procedures that we put in place were we would catch the fish on hook and line, we'd keep it whole, we would ikijimi the fish, and then we would ice slurry the fish. And then the ice slurry is where the magic happens. That's where you bring the core temperature of the fish, of the whole fish, down evenly, which sets it up for its shelf life. And then once it comes out of the slurry, we pack the fish individually in another insulated bin with their bellies down on the ice. So just constantly keeping that gut cavity cool is the aim of the game from there on out. And our turnaround with gravity was really quick. Like, I could be out fishing that morning, and if I was back by midday, I could pack fish and I could have it on the first courier that was available by 2:30 in the afternoon, which means I caught fish that morning. The following day, the restaurant gets it that morning. So it's less than 24 hours and it's with the customer.
Yeah.
So, and the thing with that ikijimi technique and that whole process that I just described is, at that stage, in those early stages before we launched, we were sending fish overseas. That's how it was. We were using a licensed fish receiver in Bluff, and we were using an export facility in Bluff as well. So it kind of had nothing to do with our business. We just were getting something going, and we used those two outlets to help us get there, which was awesome. They supported us all the way, and it was really great. It worked really well. But then, of course, I pulled back on doing the export market because I didn't really feel like it was needed. There was enough of our products being shipped offshore, and what was really needed was to give fish back to our local communities in New Zealand. So I really felt strongly that that's what needed to happen, and I knew, as every week went on and we gained customer after customer, that it was needed. And then I became aware after the first 12 months of how actual, you know, dire straits we were in as far as fish production goes in our country. You know, there wasn't a lot available. It was available from some fishing companies, but the state of the fish was terrible. And it still is today, because they're still using industrial methods of fishing and bulk harvesting, because their whole model and their export realm is percentage based, so they need volume to make it work, and that's why you're encouraged to catch as much fish as you can, because we're trying to feed 50 million people. And I guess the top 10%, or the people that I've had anything to do with in the government, physically sat down at tables with them, they really only care about that top 10%. But once I was able to sit down and speak with them and say it's not in as good a space as it should be, and we could do so much better, that's when it really started to sink in that being a supplier of the domestic market wholeheartedly was the way forward for our regime and our business. So, so that's what we roll with. So that's like a little look into what it is physically to have on the boat, and the lengths that we've gone to be as sustainable as we possibly can, and to ensure that there's fish for the future. So just doing what we did with gravity and taking the pressure off that one specific fish species and blue cod, because it was in decline, and it's still in decline today. Like the fishery's on its knees down here, because we just keep trying to take out what's there. We should really only be trying to take out, you know, what the fishery is telling us it can sustain being taken out, which would go off the last 5 years of catch history of what data that we've submitted, as all commercial fishers have to. on our digital platform now via MPI. So all that information's there. We're just not acting quick enough on it. And yeah. Our areas are too vast as well. You know, like I said, we've got 10 areas, but New Zealand is this tiny little island in the middle of the Pacific, but it's still a really significant island, and it's got so many different regions and communities that you just don't hear about. And I think if the regulators were to split them up into smaller areas and were able to regulate and have their finger on the pulse more frequently because they were there and it was only a small amount of fishes to deal with, then we could see things happening out there on the water day in and day out. And if we had that ability to do that, we could act quickly. So, for example, if we've seen that in the first 6 months of the season being open, catch rates were way down, that's when you make the decision to do something about it. Not 10 years later when we've already just basically put the fishery on its knees. You know, that's the biggest mistake I think we've made, is basically just thinking that there is no end and it's always going to be there, which is not the case, because it's been proved everywhere around the country with fish stocks declining. And, you know, there are some natural things to take into account. But I just still think that the industrialization of fishing, as in the agriculture sector as well, is what's to blame for this. We're trying to take out way too much. We're trying to focus on feeding 50 million people, and what we should be doing is trying to focus on feeding 5 million people who are in our own country. And then we could truly be self-sustainable in that space, and we could preach that. Because right now, people think that they're sustainable because they come under quota management, but in actual fact, gravity fishing as a model is living, breathing proof of us actually having done the mahi and getting the results back to be truly sustainable. So the other thing that we do is we only take out what's been ordered. So, example, we might have 200 kilograms split over 45 restaurants each week. That's specifically ordered. So we only ever take right down to the last kilo what's ordered. So we're not going out there and trying to maximize our time out on the ocean by catching as much as we can, which is basically historically what everybody's done. We're actually listening to the wild food resource and telling it and listening to it and saying, right, this is how much it can sustain being taken out. Let's level the quota at that, because then we would truly be sustainable, because we're listening to what the fish stocks are telling us it can sustain. So there's all this chat around sustainability, you know, has been quite significant in the last few years. But unless you're actually out there on the water day in and day out, week in and week out like we are, and have our finger on the pulse every day that we're out there and see what's going on and making decisions based on what's happening out there, I don't think that you can preach sustainability under that banner anymore.
You've explained so many differences in the way you're running gravity versus industrial fishing. And I guess just questioning, you're comparing it to what was happening in New Zealand and from your own experience working at Sanford for 11 years, but is what's happening in New Zealand the same as what's happening everywhere else in the world when it comes to fishing, or is it at a different level?
Yeah, so to the best of my knowledge, New Zealand is one of the only ones in the world that kind of has this quota management system. And I've had messages from people around the world, you know, asking more information about it and wanting to know more because their fish stocks in their area are declining and things like that. But yeah, the short answer is we're just taking too much. Globally. And we're not giving back, you know. And so the solution for that is to go and do aquaculture, which is, you know, that has its own environmental impacts as well. You know, sourcing food from somewhere, getting made in a lab, like the carbon footprint that goes with that and all the rest of it, like it's not all it's cracked up to be. You know, like I don't support salmon farming in New Zealand other than the guys in Central South Island, because they're using a man-made structure to create a protein. So to me, that's okay in my books. But when you go into, you know, the salt water or the sea environment that in the coastal waters around New Zealand, and you try and farm a fin fish that's not native to New Zealand, I've got a little bit of an issue with that. I just always have. That's just me, because I know that we've got a perfectly good wild food resource out there. We just need to manage it properly, and we won't need to go into that space and pump out, you know, tons and tons and tons of fish every year. Other types of aquaculture, you know, mussels and things like that is epic. I think that's great. You know, we're using that water column and their filter feeders, so we're not having to feed them and stuff like that. It naturally grows, and anything that naturally grows, like Mother Nature knows best, you know, she sorts it all out. And I think if we left it up to her, she'd sort it out again. But if we just keep the pressure on like we are in the commercial fishing scene globally, and we keep trying to take out heaps and heaps of fish that's not necessarily there, especially when it's not in season, you know, you hear all sorts of stories in our space where somebody's just gone out and got tons and tons of a specific fish species when we all know that those fish species are in that region because they're there breeding, they're spawning. And it's just, you know, you're like, why would you go up there knowing that happens? So the view of what a good fisherman was in my eyes has changed so significantly in the last few years. You know, a good fisherman in my eyes when I was growing up was someone who caught lots of fish and someone who used lots of different methods of fishing to catch it.
Yeah.
Now I'm like, okay, a good fisherman is making a business work by taking the smallest amount of fish that they can out of the ocean and doing it in the right way. That's how I view a good fisherman these days, because, you know, it has a less impact on everything that goes for after that, you know.
Yeah. One of the really interesting things you mentioned was the 12-month seasonality calendar that you pulled together.
Yeah.
And it's all based on the best oil and fat content, and it's when the fish is at its prime. And ultimately, with any food source, if you're going to be eating something, you're eating it for enjoyment, you're eating it for pleasure, you know, social situations, but you're also eating it for its nutritional value as well. And I guess that seasonality of fish is not something that commercial fishing has ever taken into consideration, nor would the general public see in a supermarket variety of fish coming at different times of year on the shelf, because it's always the same fish there. It's always there 12 months of the year. There's no change necessarily. And I would say that when it comes to seasonality of fish, that's something that the general public have absolutely no idea about.
Would you agree? Exactly. Oh, 100%, Nikki. Yeah. I mean, I always use the example of avocados. You know, if avocados are in season, they're in season. And if you're eating them out of season, they're imported. So if you want to contribute to that, you make up your own mind. But in my mind, if you're doing it for nutritional value, eat it when it's in season. You know, otherwise you're contributing to, you're part of the problem if you are as an eater buying these things that are out of season.
So the seasonality of fish, would that apply for every area in New Zealand having similar seasonalities, or is your seasonality based on just your catchment area down in the South Island?
Yeah, so mine's just done on my area specifically.
Yeah.
And it took a couple of years, about 18 months all up, that it took us to get that info. And then, like I've always said, you know, because I've had a bit of backlash here and there from people and different organizations around New Zealand that seem to be doing the right thing, or they want to be doing the right thing. But at the end of the day, we all want the same outcome, but they're going about it the wrong way and focusing on the negative and trying to bash people as commercial fishermen. But what I see is, you know, we just need to work together on it, because we're better off as a collective than as individuals to get things done. So, sure, I'm catching a harpooker down here when they're in season, but other areas, they don't have harpooker because they've obviously been wiped out, or they've moved on, or they've been all caught, or whatever the scenario is. It's no good bashing people at the bottom of the South Island when they have no idea what we're doing and the extent that we've gone to. So that's why I just focused on our area specifically initially, but now that we're trying to replicate the gravity fishing model, we will delve into that. So if we get the funding approved and we can set up these packing facilities in different regions, then for the first 12 months, 100% we're going to be doing exactly what I did before we started for that specific area, because it will be slightly different. You know, we have different currents and tidal flows and nutrients and stuff floating around, so it will be significantly different as you get up the country, I'd imagine.
Yeah. That's so interesting, though, as well, because I feel if consumers understood the seasonality of fish, it's like a lot of people didn't used to fully understand, or some still don't understand the seasonality of fruit and vegetables at times, and they want to get tomatoes all year round. And, you know, you could, but there's a process that has to be done, and there's a lot more resource intensive if you do want tomatoes all year round. But if consumers are wanting to know about fish, then it's even just starting with what fish should they have access to in their area, what should they be seeing on the shelves of their supermarket at different times of year? And we know that the supermarket's not the best example when it comes to fish, but that is in reality where a lot of people do buy their fish. So it's a place that sort of defines some of those trends too.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Yeah, when you're looking at seasonality, I guess that's one step towards reducing the impact on fish stocks, and it's one step towards sustainability. But what's the ultimate sustainability goal look like when it comes to fishing?
Yeah, like I said earlier, I think it's about taking the smallest amount of fish that you possibly can to allow your business to operate. I think that's what it is. From an ethical perspective and a sustainable perspective, that's what it is. And that's what we've done. And right now, moving into food tourism and doing the gravity experience, what we're doing, like, example is I've caught 6 fish in the last 10 days for 3 charters. And that is extremely significant to me, knowing how much fish I used to go through prior gravity and then with gravity. I personally cannot take a smaller amount of fish than what we're doing right now with the gravity experience to make my business work. And that's what it is. And I mean, you know, going back to where most people get their fish from at the supermarkets, you know, like that's the harsh reality of it. Is the 2 biggest things that I want to achieve with gravity fishing and this gravity fishing replication is accessibility and affordability. Yeah. So accessibility for a fisher or a harvester to gain access to quota so that they don't get stung with the deemed value. They have quota there ready to go. So that's the access point first and foremost, because that's the start user. And then when it flows on after, so with the gravity replication, the harvester is the one who's responsible for marketing and selling their own product. So as an eater, when you go and buy this product, or you've jumped online and you've ordered some fish from someone on the gravity replication, you can physically speak or message that same person. So that transparency and that traceability thing is just super existent in this realm.
Yeah.
Whereas before, there's a middleman set up and they scare everybody away because they say there's so much red tape that you've got to go through to get to where they are, and they work really hard and it's this and it's that, when in all reality, all they're doing is paying the fishermen the bare minimum of what they possibly can to obtain the product, telling people as the customer whatever they want, because they really have no idea, because they're just a middleman. They have no connection. There's no intimacy with that product. They're just on selling it to make as much money as they can. So they'll tell you a fuzzy story or a fluffy story to make you to get a sale. Like I said, marketing and selling and looking after our product. So if you're that engaged with it and intimate with it, you're going to look after it. It's human nature. Yeah. That's what it is.
Yeah.
It takes the greed factor out of it. You physically looking after that product as best as you possibly can. You're telling the customer direct how you caught it. Here's a small video clip on my social media platform, whatever it is. But you're getting true authenticity with it. And there's no cloudiness or dilution. And whereas if you go to the supermarket and you go, oh, yep, look, there's some blue cod fillets, there's some red cod fillets, there's some whole lemon sole, there's some grouper heads, there's that, there's salmon, da-da-da-da-da. And like you said, it's there, it's available 12 months of the year. But it's like, well, hang on a minute. Like all the blue cod down here is spawning, and you've got this little tag that says South Island blue cod. Like, where does it come from? Is it coming from the South Island? How was it harvested? You know, all these questions that kind of all come straight back and steer sustainability or question sustainability, like, right in the face. And there it is, you know. So it's huge, you know, seasonality. And that's the thing people don't understand, you know. Like, when we take a specific fish species, or when we're targeting a specific fish species when it's in season, we're taking pressure off the other wild food resources that are out there. So we're not year-round trying to target blue cod all year. We're only targeting blue cod for 2 months of the year now, because that's when it's in season. That's when it should be left alone, you know. And so I think that's where we need to go to next. I think obviously globally we need to pull back on what we're harvesting because it's not working out very well. And I guess that's that old saying, you like got to rely on the people to make the change, not the governments. And I guess that's what we're seeing now. People are waking up and they want to know where their food comes from because they are concerned about what they're putting in their bodies. And it's as much an educational change as it is a generational change, I think, because leading up to quota management system being signed off and everything in 86, we didn't have internet and stuff like that back then, but now we have it at the touch of our fingertips. So if we want to know something, it's so easy to access. And I guess that's where people are waking up, because if they want to know really where their product's coming from, they can find that out relatively easy.
Yeah. And one big change that you said in the way you're running gravity versus industrial fishing was, well, actually two, sorry, was reducing waste. So you're not having any waste by catching and shipping whole fish, but also to your time frame, your turnaround times. So you're saying that you can get that fish to the restaurant or customer, whoever it might be, within 24 hours of it being caught.
Mm-hmm.
What's the timeline for industrial fishing? How long does it take to get that fish onto someone's plate?
Yeah, okay. Let's just roll with what I know as actual fact. So an industrial fisher will go out if the weather's fine and it allows them to fish. They'll fish for as many days as the weather allows them to. So it may be 5 days at sea. So your oldest fish is obviously 5 days old. Then you come back to the port where you're fishing from, where you're registered to, and you'll unload that fish to your LFR. Now, the thing that happens quite frequently, and it's not out of the norm, is because that time frame of weather has been really good, the whole fishing fleet's out.
Yeah.
So you've got one or two licensed fish receivers who is about to receive upwards of 30 or 40 tons of fish product off, say, 10 boats or 12 boats, just rough estimates, all coming in at once, all wanting to land on the same day. And so they get to the factory, and then from there, so this fish is 5 days old. Some of it's 5 days old, some of it's 1 day old, but, you know, the gist of it is it's a five-day fishing trip. It gets landed, it'll go to the packing facility or the factory, and from there, it's generally landed on a Friday, because that's just what it is. Fishermen try and work as many good days as they can, but also know that the factories are open for 5 days of the week and not seven. So it'll, nine times out of ten, it'll get to the factory. The factory staff will sort out what's of the highest value, as in financial turnover. They'll pack and work as fast as they can to get that high-value product sorted. And that fish might go out on the same day, but it may not as well. It may sit in the factory over the weekend and then be dispatched on Monday. And then once they've done all that, you've got the lower value stuff that's coming in that's been sitting there since Friday, been on the boat for 5 days. So now you're at Monday. And then by the time they get around to processing it, it may be around 8 to 10 days, and then it'll get packaged and then it'll get distributed. So there's 10-day old fish that goes in the shop window at a supermarket, and it may sit there without being bought for another, who knows, you know, 2 to 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, whatever it is. So then you're looking at the shelf life of the fish being around 2 weeks old. And at some stage, over that period of time, it's deteriorating, it's losing its nutritional benefits or what was left of it. And I guarantee you that it hasn't been looked after and icky jimmied and slurried and everything, because that's not how you do it. You just don't have time when you're industrial fishing. When it's on, it's on, and there's fish everywhere. You know, you really start to see the deterioration of the fish. You see it in the eyes first and foremost, and then in the gills. And then slowly but surely you start to get a discoloration in the fish fillet itself, where it goes quite yellow. Part of that science behind the icky jimmy technique is it slows the rigor mortis process down, but what it does is it returns all the lactic acid and the muscle enzymes back to the gut cavity, and it returns the blood back to the gut cavity as well. So that flesh is not soured when you apply that technique. So if you're doing the industrial method, you're generally not icky jimmying, so your fish is not set up straight off the bat, and that's where you need to do the work. The work needs to be done within the first few seconds of the fish being caught and landed. And that's what you don't have time to do when you're bulk harvesting.
Yeah, because it's about how much can you get in. And I guess if you're out there for days at a row. But, yeah, I can imagine there's a lot of fish by the time you're coming back in.
Yeah.
So that gets me on to a conversation that we've briefly talked about, but around the documentary Seaspiracy, because I've had a lot of clients who have watched that, and immediately the next appointment I have with them, they say, okay, I've stopped eating all fish now. And that was the big key message at the end of that documentary, was that everyone needs to stop eating fish to solve the problem. And I guess I wanted to chat to you about that and sort of hear what your thoughts were about, is that the solution? Does everyone need to stop eating fish?
Yeah, no, definitely not. You know, fish as a wild protein is really significant on the global scale as to how much we consume and its nutritional benefits for us as humans to consume. So I don't think just going cold turkey and stopping eating fish is the answer to any of it. I'm going to be completely honest, I still haven't seen Seaspiracy, but I know enough of who made it and who funded the documentary, and I know enough to kind of make up my own mind to see what it is. You know, it's conspiracy stuff, but knowing what actually goes on out there as a harvester year after year, day after day, week after week, I can honestly say that just stopping eating fish is not the answer at all. I think the answer is delve deeper. If you want to know how that fish was caught, all of that kind of stuff, then you have to do your own work. You have to do your own research. And it's easy enough to find. But one word of advice I would give is just don't go to the mainstream mass production companies and expect that you're going to be contributing to sustainable practices, because that's not going to be the case in any way, shape or form. Like I said, it's a dated system, and as we've seen with other systems globally, they are starting to collapse because more people are waking up to it. But my advice would be is to just look for somebody local, somebody within your region or your community that is doing commercial fishing, and approach them. Then you're not contributing to that mass production realm, and you're making the right choice, because you're actively trying to sort out people who have that passion and that love for what they do, but they also want to look after the wild food resource and farm it so it's there for future generations, instead of just taking it all out now and seeing no end. So don't just stop eating fish because it's really good for us. You know, you'll know that better than anyone, Nikki. Like, it's really, like, we eat fish probably, we're really fortunate to eat fish maybe like once or twice a week, and we really benefit from it. It's great. Yeah. It's a great thing.
And I think it's a really good point that just stopping eating something doesn't change the way that food is caught, managed, processed, anything like that. Just stopping eating it is not going to change those industrial processes, because that's not enough of a demand or of a push to get them to change the way they're doing things.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, we're visible now. Harvesters are visible now, and we have a voice, and we are being heard. Well, 2020, we got nominated for a couple of categories in the Sustainable Seafood Awards and ended up taking out the Emerging Leader Award and a finalist in the Value Added category as well. So we are definitely being heard. But this will be my only doom and gloom point, I suppose, is it's not too late, but it's getting quite far down the line now that we actually probably should have done something about it 10 years ago. And that's where I was, you know, getting at before in regards to the regulators having smaller areas to manage so that they could be more intimate. They could have that working relationship with the harvesters, as opposed to just the digital email saying, you know, this or that. And then actually bringing them there to have that intimacy and that connection so that they can understand what you're doing and why you're doing it. Because I wouldn't be doing it if I didn't love it, and there'd be no other fishermen out there that wouldn't say that they're doing it because they don't love it, you know. That's what we've chosen to do, that's what we're good at. But now that we have a voice, we need to start being heard, and we need to start standing up and backing each other. And that again goes back to what I was saying before in regards to, you know, different angles of people trying to achieve things. We all want to achieve the same thing. But in my eyes, I think that from the commercial fishing sector, you need to go to the source. And the source is the person who turns the key, baits the hooks, and icky jimmies the fish. And that's the only two people that matter in this conversation, is the start user and the end user.
Mm.
And just making yourself available to speak to anybody or any one of your customers and explain anything that they want to know, and just being upfront and honest and just putting it out there and being 100% transparent. And that's what social media has platforms have brought to the game, is that very aspect of it, is traceability and transparency. People can see what I'm doing and then go and eat at a restaurant. And let's just use Alex Davies for an example. I'll go catch some fish. I'll take a photo of it. I'll send it to Alex. Alex puts it on his social media platform and say, okay, on Tuesday, Gravity Fish is going to be arriving at the restaurant. Doors open at 7 o'clock on Wednesday evening. Come down and try it. And then so buyers will go there, or eaters will go there, jump on the social media platform that we have a look at the fish being caught a day before, and then eat it. And so they have that connection.
Yeah.
Albeit like it's digital, but they still can see, holy hell, this is a butterfish that Nate's caught, and now it's here in front of me, and it's been served up by one of New Zealand's best chefs, and the whole picture's connected. So you don't have that doubt, you know, like we still go out and order something and be like, man, wonder where this is from, you know, like it doesn't really smell that great. Or
the number
you know,
of times that question gets asked at a restaurant, I wonder where that's from. Landlocked areas.
Exactly.
I wonder where this fish came from.
and then you know, no fault of like the front of house or anything, but all they can say is, oh, it's just like market caught fish from this outfit or whatever. Whereas if you're marketing and selling it yourself, then you know this, it's transparent.
And one new branch of Gravity, your new so like hook to plate experiences. So talk to me about that. What does that involve?
Yeah, so that's just my way of being as sustainable as I possibly can as far as seafood production goes. So what it is it's definitely food tourism, but it's an experience as well. So basically, over the years working with these chefs and stuff, we've developed friendships, and you know, very, very humbled to be able to call some of these humans friends of mine. And yeah, just got chatting to them. And the whole idea came out when COVID first happened, when we went into lockdown. Because it's only myself and Anna, my wife, in the business, we were able to keep operating because we didn't have heaps of staff, and we didn't have to practice social distancing and stuff. So we got an exemption to still be able to process fish. And during that period of time, there was basically only us doing seafood production in the whole country.
Yeah.
So, you know, no other fishers were able to go out and land to a big LFR because a big LFR's got staff and they couldn't perform social distancing, which means they couldn't operate.
Yeah.
At the same time, some of these guys were working at high-end lodges, and obviously restaurants weren't open and stuff. And so everybody got affected by it, but a lot of the crew lost their jobs overnight. But what I did see was an opportunity. And the opportunity that I seen to launch this was the fact that now we're all locked in our own country, but we still want to travel as Kiwis. You know, it's just what we do. And when you travel, you want authenticity. That's what you gain when you go and travel. You go to these places, you know, when I used to travel, that's why I used to travel. So I could go and experience something firsthand, and you take away from that so much more than you would if you did papers or research and stuff on it. It's being there physically, feeling the humidity and the smell and all of that kind of stuff. It's so important to have. And that's what it was with this Gravity experience, is we now have a platform where you can come and experience it yourself, so that you can feel the sway of the boat and you can smell the smells and the surroundings and gain that sense of authenticity. And as you're catching these small amounts of fish, because how it works is the chef comes down, the chef, myself, will take you out on these experiences. You get on the boat and we'll ask you straight away, what kind of protein would you like to have on your menu this evening or for lunch today? And then I'll just basically give them a quick breakdown of what's in season at the time. And then that's basically your options. So right now we're in the oyster season. It's also mutton birding season as well. And so I'd just be like, well, okay, this is what we have on offer as far as proteins go for this trip. What would you like to have on the menu? And so we'd go out and get enough oysters to feed however many the party was. And again, enough mutton birds or whatever. So only taking that small amount, what you need for that meal that night. And so I'm constantly talking to the chef, asking about what sort of volume of product we're going to need. And they'll make the decision based off the group. And then we go and harvest that. And while we're doing that, I give everybody a bit of running commentary of the area that we are, you know, in at the time, a bit of history about the product that we're harvesting. And then I show them step by step how I've been doing it with gravity, you know, with the Ikki Jimmy technique, if it's wet fish, the tradition that's involved with mutton birding and stuff like that, because it's a customary right. So not everybody can go and do that. Example, took some guys, some winemakers and some chefs away about 10 days ago, and we went down to the Mutton Bird Island and we harvested some, well, the family that was on the island harvested some mutton birds, but they kept them in a natural state so that everybody had their own mutton bird to hold on to. Mm-hmm. Still had the feathers and the wings and everything on it. So, and then I showed them how to pluck a bird, how to gut it, how to water clean it and do that process. So you're really actually, you're as involved as you want to be, but you can also just kick back and look at it as well. Like, there's no obligation to get involved and get your hands dirty. Like, at the end of the day, you're on holiday and you're having this experience. So yeah, so from there, once we have the product, we come back to Half Moon Bay at Stewart Island, and then we go around to the beachfront accommodation that we have access to. And then from there, that's when the chef takes over as the chief educator. And again, it's entirely how much involvement you want to achieve, is everybody's personal preference. But the platform is that the chef will then show you how to clean and break down the seafood that we've harvested that day, some cooking techniques, just basically whatever they're doing in the kitchen, and having it all there in front of you happening, so that you're completely involved right from when you've baited the hook till it's been served up in front of you.
Yeah.
And the whole thing works because it's a beautiful part of the country that we have access to here, pristine waters around Stewart Island, so many different options and layers to go with it. You know, we offer an experience that where we have the lodge, it can be one day, it can be three nights, it can be whatever it is. It's completely customizable to fit what you want to do and how much time you've got. We've also got another layer to be added whereby we can take small intimate groups away on the boat with us and physically stay on the boat, so not go back to the lodge.
Yeah.
Still have the chef on board, but just more of a sort of a rustic, organic feel with it, I suppose. Yeah. You're constantly on the water and you're not setting foot on land. But yeah, they're really special places that we go to, and the memories that you take away from these experiences is, everybody keeps telling me it's once in a lifetime, and I'm like, no, but I'll see you next year though. And they're like, yeah, absolutely. So it's like, you know, people want this.
I guess going at different times of year, people get to experience different produce that's in season as well, and learn the different techniques. Yeah. So if you went at different times of year, the experience would be completely different every time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's it. And that just based on the ethos that we rolled out with gravity, you know, sustainable packaging, compostable, reusable, all that kind of stuff. We didn't want to do things, you know, one foot in one door, one foot in the other. It just had to be done right from the get-go. Otherwise, it's kind of contradicting. So that's what we did. And this thing's just flowed into the next thing, you know. So we're only hand harvesting, catching fish with hand harvest, a hook, or a spear gun, and that's it. So there's no industrial methods of fishing used on these charters. And then that way people get the opportunity to, you know, feel a fish on the end of a line and that whole process and gain that authenticity, because that's ultimately what we're all after at the end of the day, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And what are some simple things that people could do that could make a difference towards fish, seafood industry, anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, that's it. People always talk about markets to me, markets this and markets that, mainly comes from fishermen. And I'm like, what markets are you talking about? And they're like, there's no markets. Yeah. And I'm like, so, you know, the consumer or the eater has the biggest part to play in this.
Yeah.
And that's making the right choice. So just sort after, go and look for anybody who, if you want to eat a wild food resource in your region, go and do the research, figure out what you want to support or how you can support, and spread the word. You know, if you've found a good company that maybe they're not super local, but they're doing everything ethically possible to be as sustainable as they possibly can, support them, tell people about them, get other people excited, tell them about the product and the quality. Like, getting stuff from us and our platform is, you will not be disappointed, because it only goes through one set of hands till it gets to you. You know, it's super, super fresh. The quality is outstanding every time. It's not one of those things where you get something really good, you know, and you go back and it's completely different, but it's the same item on the menu. It's not like that. We're handling with one fish at one time, and we're not doing anything else until we've done with that fish.
Mm.
So that quality really shines through, and you will get this product and you will be able to do that. But I guess ultimately, look for the right choices, make the right choices, and spread the word, because what we need right now is lots of little options.
Yeah.
We don't need a handful of big companies telling us how it is. We don't need that anymore. That would be my thing. Look for the little guys who do it themselves, and look after them, because they're the ones that are truly trying to do things on the ground, you know. People making the difference, making the right choices is what's going to change. Ultimately, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome, Nate. And thinking about our conversation and your work and the work you do with Gravity, but also just what's happening in the world with regards to fish and fish stocks, what would be your three key take-home messages for people listening?
Oh, crikey, that's a good question. Yeah, again, just do that research, make the right choices, try and do it as close to home as you possibly can so that you minimize that footprint, because ultimately we just have been polluting the globe for years and it's, you know, starting to show a bit, things are suffering. Make the right choices for your wild proteins that you're wanting to eat or serve to your family and friends.
Yeah,
just do the research in the right places. Even growing, you know, growing your own food, saving your own seeds and things like that. Like gain that knowledge so that you can ultimately sustain your family first and foremost. And all of that knowledge that you gain, pass it on to people that are close to you who may not have that access, because the more that we do that and the more compassion we show for each other and help each other out and not rely on regulatory things, I think that's going to make the world a better place, because we'll all survive. We'll all be a lot healthier, because obviously they're not going to have that footprint on the thing. The produce is going to be a lot better because we're more intimately connected to it and we're doing things in a way without all of the things that come with industrialization, like putting things on pastures to make it grow fast and to gain milk production and all of those things that are just, if we just keep it really small, and just look after each other, your neighbors, and then out into your wider community, then I think that's a massive thing as well, that would really help everybody out. And, you know, mental, physical state of mind and mental and physical well-being is the things that come after that. If we're eating the right things, if we're eating the right things that are in season in our body and our regions and our countries that we're from, then we can't really go wrong. But just support small where you can, when you can, I think is the other one. Because there's so much stuff, like I have to go through as much paperwork as a big industrial fishing shed does. I have to do the same paperwork, even though it's just a one-man band or two people in this band. So, yeah, just supporting small's massive, I think.
Yeah.
For sure.
That's such a key point, isn't it, Nate? And if people do want to support Gravity or find out more about the work you're doing, how do they find you?
Yeah, so we've just got a website, which is basically 100% for the Gravity experience. But the main thing is it's a point of contact that you can start with to get in touch with us. We will, once we get this funding signed off, we'll have a whole nother ordering platform and a different website that goes with it. But for now, we've just gravityfishing.co.nz is the website. So that gives you a good insight as to what we do with the experience and not so much from the commercial fishing side of it. But, yeah, that's pretty much the main port of call for anybody wanting to know more. Or my social media platform on Instagram, which is just Gravity Fishing, just flick us a message, and that's also another way to get through.
Yeah, and I guess that's the great platform where everyone can see behind the scenes of what goes on out on the water as well, which is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
that's awesome, Nate. Well, thanks so much for joining me in conversation today about fish and what's going on. And it's definitely cleared up a few questions I had, but also has raised, I think the biggest thing for me to take away is the importance of the seasonality when it comes to fish. So I hope to see some developments on this in years to come, that there is this big push towards the consumer knowing about seasonality when it comes to fish.
Yeah, you're welcome, Nikki. No worries. Happy to help where I can. It's all good.
Thank you so much for joining me for this week's episode. Don't forget to subscribe so you can find out when new episodes are released throughout the season. If you loved this episode, please consider leaving a review and share it with your friends, family, or anyone who you think might also enjoy tuning in. Until next week, you can follow the podcast and my work over on Instagram and Facebook at Nourish with Nikki. And to find out more about working with me, visit NikkiHerstas.com. See you again next week.